Okay, so welcome to the last lecture. So unfortunately, I managed to catch a cold last days. So hopefully my voice holds. But we don't need the entire duration this for this last lecture, so I guess 1 hour or so. And then at the end, I will talk a bit about the examination. So some remarks on the examination, which will be an oral examination. Okay, so last lecture we talked about caches and several levels of caches, cache architectures, direct map cache, set associative caches, and so on. And today, the last lecture, I want to just to connect the entire thing. So I would talk about multi-core, multi-threaded processors, their connection to the caches. The links to the caches, memory crossbars, and as well give some examples. So to conclude this lecture. So if you look at many cores or multi cores, then you can try to classify these. So we can distinguish two types. First, the non-composable or static multi cores or many cores just means they have a static number of cores and the cores are static and unchangeable. So maybe I have 8 cores or so, and I can distinguish now between the homogeneous, like we have the Core i5, Core i7, or the Sun Ultra Spark, or the AMD FX series, where we have a given number of the same core, and we can have heterogeneous. So we as well introduced you the IBM cell processor with this power processing element and synergistic processing elements. Or vector streaming machines, all this chip multiprocessing. But there is another possibility, it's still a bit rare, but there are the composable dynamic multi-core architectures, which means where the cores are not static. You have some kind of reconfigurable hardware in there where you can change the structure, the architecture of a core at runtime. This is used quite often, or more and more often, in embedded systems, because, for instance, I can adapt my core at runtime, maybe in a coarse grain way, that I just switch between predefined cores and say, okay, I have a FPGA field, for instance, in my processor, and I can, depending on the needs, I can switch this to process fast Fourier transformation, or to process some control algorithms or support this efficiently by hardware. This can go down up to fine-grain reconfiguration, where I can switch down to the register and gate level at runtime. And usually these cores are heterogeneous because, when I can reconfigure a core, it doesn't make really sense to have all the same cores reconfigured the same way. So having homogeneous, composable multi-cores is a bit questionable, so I don't think this will exist, but this will be mostly heterogeneous. Okay, this is did I have the annotated version? This is an old version. I just noticed this is an old version. I did some annotation here. Just let me switch to the new version. Obviously, I managed to open the wrong one. That's the annotated version, yeah. It changed a bit. The old slides. There are marks where I wanted to change something in the slides. Okay, here we are. Same slide set, but the newer version. Okay, now since we have seen all this cache stuff, I want to have a closer look at some processor parameters from processors before 2005. And there I have three processors as an example. I have the Piranha. The Piranha is an 8-core processor based on 8 DEC Alpha processors combined in a first research version. And then finally in the full custom version. And the next generation microprocessor was in 2005 a highly speculative microprocessor design. And you see here clock frequency is about 500 megahertz, 1 gigahertz, while the full custom Piranha was at 1.25 gigahertz. And at the end of the lecture, I will try to compare a bit, or we'll try to work out what's better, having a single high power core, fully speculative wide issue bandwidth, or a large number of small or narrow issue bandwidth simple cores. And this is a bit extreme, because the next generation is a single core processor with a wide issue bandwidth for four instructions at a time, so four times superscalar out of order execution, while the Piranha has eight simple cores, completely in order scalar, so it's a scalar processor. So we don't have an instruction window here, while here the instruction window is 64 instructions. The cache line is identical, so last lecture we learned about that the cache is organized in lines, and this is a usual cache line, 64 bytes, and the level 1 cache size is for all three 64 kilobytes, and it's a two-way set associated cache, so it's this variant where I have two possibilities for each memory entry to be placed. The level 2 cache size is 1 megabyte or 1.5 megabytes here. And in the first version of the Piranha, it was an 8-way set associative cache, but they changed this. They found out the 6-way is a bit simpler, and the 8-way doesn't really have this much gain that the hardware effort pays. And the next generation processors as well, a 6-way associative cache. The L2 hit latency is 16 nanoseconds here, 12 nanoseconds here. Interestingly, you have here at the Piranha, you not only have a hit latency, but as well a forward latency. This is quite interesting, what's behind this forward latency. And this means the following. This is an architecture which is coupled on the level 2 cache level. So we have the level 1 cache of one processor, another level 1 cache of another processor. So this is processor 1, and this is processor 2. And then we have a common L2 cache. And the forward latency is the following. Processor 2 wants to access a data which is not in this level 1 cache, but it's actually in this level 1 cache. Then this level 1 cache can forward its data via the level 2 cache to here. This is what forwarding means. So in such a multi-cache architecture, one cache can forward its data to another cache. And this can be done here in 24 nanoseconds, respectively in 16 nanoseconds in the final version of this. This pays, as you see, the local memory latency is 18 nanoseconds, while the remote memory latency is 120 nanoseconds. As far as the memory is away from the chip, as slower the memory gets. That's a problem due to the communication issues. And the remote dirty latency is 180 nanoseconds. This is dirty means I have to write back a modified block to the memory. Local memory is memory closer to on the same chip, while remote memory is memory which is off chip. So we have the communication issues. So you can on the Piranha, it was mentioned. It was that I have these 8 cores, which are mapped via the level 2 cache, and then I can have here as well local memory on the same chip. And I can have remote memory via bus interface, which is off-chip. Okay, when looking at multithreading, CMT stands for chip multithreading. Usually, here are some sample parameters. You can have chip multithreading in order, scalar or superscalar. Usually, chip multithreading architectures are in order, not out of order. With a scalar two-way or four-way superscalar with usual pipeline depth of 8 stages. Instruction data path or ALUs, usually 1 to 4. If I'm 4 times superscalar, then I have, of course, usually four integer ALUs. Cache size, if I look at the level 1 cache, data and instruction cache, about 1.8 kilobyte to 128 kilobyte. Cache lines, 16 bytes for the data cache, 30 bytes for the instruction cache, typically. Associativity, we have either on the level 1 cache, direct map cache, 4-way, 2-way, 4-way, or 8-way set associative cache, while the cache policy is usually write-through policy. And this when I have 2, 4, 8-way set associative, I use usually some kind of LOU, at least recently used replacement strategy. The clock frequency of these processors usually were, I have to to explain what ITRS means. ITRS is an abbreviation, and it stands for International Transistor Roadmap of Semiconductors, which is a gas, like a SIA roadmap. It's international. Transistor roadmap. T stands for transistor, S stands for semiconductor at least. Actually, just Google it. What it means. It's a, like the SIA, Semiconductor International Association, it's a roadmap where they guess in advance what will happen in the next years. And they made as well a guess about the clock frequencies, for instance, in 2008. And the real clock frequency is about a third or a half of the estimate, because they didn't foresee really the heat of the memory, the heat wall we have by increasing the clock frequency. So the guess for 2008 of clock frequency was about 6 gigahertz or so. And we're still at 3 to 4 gigahertz. Value threading, usually if I have one, I can have up to 32 threads per core usually. Level 2 cache as a 1 to 8 megabyte, 128 byte lines. Coherent bank cache. I will show you a later bit what a bank cache here in that case, that case means, while the main memory is dual inline memory packs with several channels and about 135 cycle latency, which is about, yes, about 80 nanoseconds. Okay. Now I want just to pick an example to show you more detail how a multi-core processor works together with the level 1 cache, the level 2 cache, and how the interconnection between the caches and the processor can be handled. And as an example, I have selected the Sun UltraSpark, which is as well has the code name Niagara, which was firstly introduced in 2005 and then extended in 2008 to the Niagara 2. Which is a chip multiprocessor CMP for server applications. And the idea was, or the goal was, to have a really high throughput while having low power consumption, which means an excellent performance per watt, which is more important today to have the performance per watt. So the MIPS per watt is quite a very important measure. And this is a quite interesting thing because it's based on the Spark core. Spark stands for Scalable Processor Architecture. Spark Scalable Processor Architecture, which is in fact a scalar processor architecture. It's a quite old scalar processor architecture, and the UltraSpark combined 8 of these scalar pipelines on a single die, which is in fact a 32-bit Spark, and each pipeline was extended to be four times multi-threaded. So each pipeline was enriched to a multi-threaded pipeline, being able to serve up to 4 threads per hardware. So we can have up to 4 threads in the pipeline at different stages of the pipeline. And coupled on the basis of L2 cache, so each pipeline has its own level 1 cache, and they are coupled on the basis of L2 cache in the UMA architecture, uniform memory architecture, which means that each processor has an identical view of the main memory. This is what UMA means, and double data rate controllers were used here. So here you see the architecture. So we have the 8 Spark pipelines. Each of these Spark pipelines, 4-way multi-threaded. We have a local level 1 cache, which is not noted here. It's part of the level 1 cache besides here. In fact, yes. I changed the slides, then forgot about my pencil. So here is locally the level 1 cache. And we have the level 2 cache here. And the level 2 cache is organized in 4 banks. These are 4 separate banks. And the advantage is that if I would have a single level 2 cache bank, I would get an access conflict if more than one core tries to access the level 2 cache at the same time. But by dividing the cache into separate banks, there is a certain probability that if two pipelines try to access at the same time the level 2 cache. These accesses are in different banks, so there will be no conflict. So you see, you can have here in the four banks, we can have up to four simultaneous accesses to the level 2 cache without having a conflict as long as these four accesses are in different banks each. This is the idea why to split the level 2 cache in several banks. And each bank has its own memory controller, which is using a double data rate interface connected to the dynamic RAM of the main memory. And we have as well I/O and shared functions to the I/O interface. And the connection between the eight pipelines and the four cache banks is realized by a crossbar. I will come to this crossbar in a few moments. And as well, the connection to the I/O and shared functions is realized via the same crossbar here. So here you see the processor die. So you can see the spark cores here, the first four cores, the next four cores. Here in the middle, there is a crossbar. You can see the four banks of the level 2 cache. And you can see as well what we learned in the last lecture, that the cache does not consist of a single memory. A cache, in fact, is two memories. So you have here the L2 data bank and the L2 tag bank. So here the data is stored, and here the tag information for address comparison is stored here. So yeah, these are the main features. Here are the interfaces to the main memory then here. So it's quite well-structured architecture here. And you can see here the crossbar residing in the middle. And you see the complexity of the crossbar is quite high, and these are mostly buses here. What you see are buses. I will come to the crossbar a bit later on the next slides. But first, let's have a look at the pipeline. It's a simple Spark pipeline enriched by multi-threading. It's a six-stage pipeline. We have the standard Spark pipeline is a five-stage pipeline, which has a fetch stage, the decode, the execute, the memory, and the write-back phase, like we know, quite standard. And enriching this to multi-threading, there was introduced a sixth stage, which is a select stage. So we have here the program counter. You see we have a four-thread pipeline, so we have four program counters. For each thread, a separate program counter. Then we have the instruction cache and the instruction table look-aside buffer, where we fetch instructions from each of these four threads and store these instructions in the instruction buffer. So we have finally here four instruction buffer. So each thread has its individual instruction buffer where instructions are collected for a thread. And then we have in the select stage of the pipeline the thread select logic, which determines in this stage from which thread the next instruction is fed in the pipeline. So this is not an SMT, not a simultaneous multithreading pipeline, but a scalar multithreading pipeline, as I introduced initially, where we don't have parallel execution units, but we can have in each stage of the pipeline instructions from different threads. And this is the initial purpose of this was, as I mentioned in the lecture there, latency hiding. Because I can, when one thread occurs a latency, I switch just to another, which runs in the shadow. So you see then we have as well four register files. So each thread has its individual register file. But we have only a single ALU. We have a single data cache, and there is as well a crypto core processor for cryptography. So it's a quite shallow pipeline, only six stages deep. It's very low speculative. So we have a branch target cache to identify branches and to get the branch targets. And we have some kind of a pre-compute branch logic, so it's fast, remember from the lecture, the fast comparent branch logic, to calculate the condition quite quickly. However, there is no branch speculation here. The only speculative thing is the branch target buffer, but no really branch speculation. And it's single issued, which means the maximum instruction per cycle rate is one. So it's a standard scalar multi-threaded pipeline, where it just can have each stage of the pipeline just contains a single instruction, but the instruction can be from different threads. So the decode might decode an instruction on thread 1, while the execute at the same time executes the instruction on thread 2, and so on. And the multithreading itself is done on a fine-grained way, which means it's a cycle-by-cycle multithreading interleaving has been used. For each cycle, the thread is switched. And to what thread the switch is done is done by a priority least recent use, so the least recent use thread, active thread, is then activated. So in fact, to make this a bit more clear, we have a switching between available threads each cycle with priority given to the least recently used thread. And we can have, in best case, up to four available threads, means all four threads are active, but as well, threads may become unavailable. And they may become unavailable because they might have long latencies, such as load instructions, branches, multiply divide instructions, all the instructions which produce some kind of latencies in the pipeline. This is well one of the techniques we discussed when multithreading. These loads might have cache misses. Branches might have a we have to compute the branch target and branch condition. Multiply and divide. When you, as you see here, it's a there is a multiply divide shift unit, but it's a multi-cycle unit, so it takes time for that. And if a thread runs in one of these instructions, it gets unavailable. So normally have four threads. Thread four. But it might happen that, for instance, one thread gets unavailable. So it's currently not available. Then the cycle by cycle interleaving is done between the three threads. And the advantage is that when I initially introduced cycle by cycle interleaving some lectures ago, I mentioned that cycle by cycle interleaving gets quite ineffective if I have not enough available threads, because when I really switch every cycle, so as and I have only, for instance, one available thread, then would the processor would just do nothing for three cycles and coming back. By this technique, I just make the cycle by cycle interleaving on the basis of the available threads. So in fact, if I have only one available thread, then no interleaving is done at all. So the processor just works on the single thread. So this is some kind of an extension of cycle by cycle interleaving, avoiding this drawback here. Another possibility are then, of course, pipeline stalls by cache misses, traps, or resource conflicts. This is another thing which makes threads unavailable. And so what we have, if we have now eight pipelines, each pipeline can execute up to four threads, and we have from the ground up a design to have overall 32 thread chip multiprocessing here. Come on. Sometimes this device is not reliable. Okay, here you can see a sketch of the thread scheduling. Here, for the thread selection, we assume that all threads are available. We just first look at a line. So we look at one instruction here. Just, for instance, look at this line. So what we do is we fetch an instruction from thread 0. Then we select instruction from thread 1. So we switch to the next thread. And then we the next, so this is a cycle process. So first cycle, second cycle, and so on. After selecting instruction from thread 1, we decode the instruction from thread 1, we execute it, we do the memory and the write-back phase. So this is the run over the time, first cycle, and here you see the switch to the next one. And if we look in a diagonal way, we can see what the units do from cycle by cycle. So if you're looking here, see what the units do. So we fetch an instruction from thread 0, we fetch an instruction from thread 1, we fetch an instruction from thread 2, we fetch an instruction from thread 3. We select instruction from thread 0, thread 1, thread 2, thread 3, thread 0, and so on. Decode thread 0, thread 1, thread 2, thread 3, thread 0, and so on. You can see here by the diagonal way how this works. And you can see as well that we always select an instruction and then fetch the instruction. So in the select stage, we always jump to the next. Okay, so I would like to look a bit closer then on the resources and the interlinking of the resources in the Niagara. And so we have to see how the pipelines are connected with the level 1 cache, the level 2 cache, the DRAM controller and the I/O device, but we don't have a closer look at the I/O devices. We are not interested in the I/O devices. But here as well, we have chip interconnection networks we have to look at, which means buses or crossbars here. Okay, let's have first a look at the level one cache here. So each processor has an exclusive level one cache for instructions and for data. But the level one cache is shared between the four threads. So all the four threads are loaded from the same level one cache. And the level one cache is astonishingly small. So the level one instruction cache is a 16 kilobyte cache, four way set associative with a block size of 32 bytes. And we fetch two instructions in each cycle. One we know, and one additional speculative that we assume that we need the next instruction, which might not be true when there is a branch instruction. While the level one data cache is 8 kilobytes, even smaller, four-way set associative with a block size of only 16 bytes. And interesting, we have here a write-through policy, not a write-back policy, meaning for write operations, the cache is in fact useless. Write-through means that we, as we remember in the last lecture, when we do a change, we always do the change at the same time in the cache and in the next higher level, main memory here in the level 2 cache. And as well, in the last lecture, I showed you that there is a possibility to speed up the write-through policy by having a write buffer between that. I draw this on the blackboard here. I made a sketch on the blackboard. I showed you, okay, here is the, for instance, here then the level one cache in our case, and the level two cache, which is the next instance here. And when writing, we have here a small buffer, which means I can here write and forget. I write and I start to perform a write operation, which means the write operation is stored in the buffer, and then I can always access the next entry in this cache, while this write operation then is done automatically in the background by the cache controller. And as well, I mentioned that, of course, there is a limited buffer capacity. And the buffer capacity here are 8 positions. So we have an 8 entry store buffer, which means we can have up to 8 simultaneous write operations before this buffer gets full. Okay, so we have quite small level one caches, and we have a 3-clock latency for cache hit, and the miss rate is about in the range of 10% for this architecture. Interestingly, is why not having larger caches? And there was a statement from James Lawton, which from Sun, which was the chief designer, with the question, why choose such small level one caches by four-way set associativity? And he mentioned that normally when I have server applications, the level one caches must in fact be much larger to really have an effect to see. So I would need at least, let's say, 128 kilobytes of level one cache to really see an effect on that. So the designers observed that I have only incremental performance gain when I make the cache from 8 to 16 or 16 to 32, which in fact does not really pay the area increase I have here. And so the idea in the Niagara was to use multi-threading instead. So having a combination of a small cache with multi-threading, that four threads showed here quite an effective way in hiding latencies from level one and level two misses. So what we have here is some kind of a trade-off. We have a small level one cache size in combination with the four threads, where we can switch to bridge the latency when we have a cache miss. Which is in fact a real, real good trade-off, and as we see later on as well in energy, because a larger cache costs much more energy than the thread management here. So this is the idea, why to combine here small caches with multi-threading. Okay, let's have a look at the level 2 cache. Level 2 cache is a single on-chip common shared cache with four banks, pipeline, total size of 3 megabytes, 12-way set associative with a block size of 64 bytes. And we have four banks which are interleaved at the 64-byte granularity, which means this is done the following way. So we have 64 bytes Next 64. Next 64. And then the next 64, and then the next line starts. This is bank zero. Bank one, bank two, bank three. And 64 bytes each, which means if I have consecutive addresses starting here, instance for address zero, then I run through the first bank, the second, the third, and after having 256 bytes finished, I come back to the first bank here, which means from the bank selection, I use obviously the addresses between the address 7 and 6, address bits. So if I look at the address, then I have the address bits 5 to 0. These address bits, address within the 64 bytes of the of cache bank, and then the bits 6 and 7. So this is within the cache, within bank. The bits select the bank. So these two bits, I select one of these banks, and here then starting from bit 8 up to bit 31, this is the remaining of the address, which then is divided via the cache bank. So each address which has bit 7 and 6 identical reflect to the same bank. So then I get bank collisions. For every access where bit 7 and 6 are different, I get no bank conflict because they are directed to different banks. So if I have a level 1 cache miss, data cache miss, and I have to refer to the level 2 cache, it takes me a 23 clock latency. So I have a 23 clock penalty. If you remember that, here we have 3 clock latency when I have a level 1 cache hit, and then 23 clocks latency when I have a level 2 cache hit and a level 1 cache miss, at least for the data cache, and 21 clock cycle less for the instruction cache. Actually, don't ask me why this is 1 clock cycle less, I don't know. Some reason. And they use, as I introduced last lecture, a full MASI-based protocol between the level 1 and the level 2 cache to maintain cache coherence. And this line replacing some sort of LOU is used here. Okay, when we look at the issue having a single shared level 2 cache, so multiple level 1 cache but a single level 2 cache, the big advantage is that I can have the communication between the processor on the level 2 cache level. So I don't need to consider cache coherence between level 2 and the main memory. Just imagine if I have separate level 1 cache, separate level 2 cache, and then a common main memory, I have to maintain cache coherence between level 1 cache, level 2 cache, and the main memory. So I have a 3-stage cache coherence protocol to run, while here I only have a 2-stage cache coherence protocol. I need only to have maintain cache coherence between the level 1 cache and the level 2 cache, while then the level 2 cache and memory are automatically coherent because there's only one level 2 cache and one main memory. So this is not a problem. So this makes it more simple and the communication quite efficient. The disadvantage is, of course, that I might get longer access time to the level 2 cache if I have bank conflicts, which means that I have maybe highly frequented banks due to some memory anomaly, where many accesses reflect to the same bank, and then this bank might, of course, become a bottleneck. So this is a disadvantage. It's the price you have to pay for that. Okay, now how to interconnect 8 processors to form memory banks. And one obvious way to do this is use a crossbar switch. And just to remind what a crossbar is, a crossbar means I have a non-blocking N-to-M connections. Have the next slide here, you see it a bit better. So I have N to M, in that case N is equal to M, but this can be as well here. Let's say in our case, this would be here. Go from 0 to 7 because we have 8 cores and to 4 if we only would look at the bank. And at these interconnection points, I can make a connection, say, okay, I connect now this input to this output. And all this can be done in parallel, which means I can, at the same time, without having a conflict, the source 0 can send to the destination 1, while the source 1 can send to the destination 2, the source 2 can send to the destination 3, and the source 3 can send to the destination 0 at the same time without having a conflict. And I can switch this as well. I can say, now no longer I want to connect this there. I want to now change the connection, connect 0 to 3, and at the same time connect then 3 to 1, so remove this connection. I'm making another color perhaps to show this. So then connect the two here. Just to change the configuration. Now 0 can connect to 3, while 2 might be able to connect to 1 at the same time without having any conflict here. So this is the idea of an N times M crossbar. And so we have, it's non-blocking, so no conflicts. Between the N and the M. We have N inputs, M outputs, which means individual switches in each cross node, and a large memory bandwidth up to several gigabytes for each bus. So this is the idea of an N times M crossbar. So this is a really, really ideal way to interconnect, let's say, N cores to M memory banks. Okay, now let's look at the configuration here. So we have, in fact, 8 pipelines. We have 4 memory banks. Then we have the I/O, and we have the floating point unit, which is separate here. And we have to interconnect these. And this is done by the crossbar. And in fact, we have 2 crossbars. We have crossbar for the direction from the CPU to the memory banks and controller. This is what they call the processor cache crossbar. The forward crossbar, which goes from the CPUs down here. And here we have an 8 to 5 crossbar, which means we have the 8 CPUs as source, and we have 5 destinations. The destinations are the 4 banks and the I/O bridge and the FPU are put together as one destination in the direction, down direction. And we have the cache processor crossbar, the other direction, the backward crossbar, which then goes just the opposite direction. And of course, here we have 6 sources because it would not make much sense to connect 2 to a single source. So here we have 6 sources, which are sources and 8 destinations. So we have 6 times 8 backward crossbar. So this is a configuration. And some more detailed information first on the forward crossbar, on the processor to cache crossbar, the PCX. So it accepts packets from the source, which is one of the 8 SPARC CPUs we had, and delivers the packet to its destination, which is one of the 4 L2 cache banks, or the I/O bridge or the FPU in common. So the source sends a package, data packet via the bus and the destination ID. The destination tells where to deliver this package. And we have separate buses for that. So we have a 124-bit wide parallel bus, which is 40 bits address and 64-bit data and control to send the packets. And then we have a 5-bit parallel bus for the destination to determine the destination. And each source connects, has of course its own separate bus to the PCX, which means so each source has its own individual bus. Otherwise, we would have conflicts if we wouldn't have individual buses here. And there is as well a handshaking there. So once the source has sent a package to the destination, the destination sends back a grant to confirm that the package was received. And as well, there is a possibility, and the problem is that the CPUs are faster than the caches, obviously, there is a possibility of a stall, which means a CPU is sending more data to the same cache as the cache can handle, and then I get a stall. And this is well handled here, so we have either the possibility that the bus sends a ground signal back to the source, which means, okay, the cache has received the data, or when the limit is reached, it sends a stall signal back, which means stop now, no more communication until you get the next grant signal. So we have, in fact, 8 buses that connect from the CPUs to the crossbar. Here it's shown we have the eight buses from the CPU to the PCX crossbar, and then the four buses which connect to the four cache banks, and the one bus which is common for the aero bridge and the floating point unit. Okay, let's have a look here. What is the advantage? So we have a non-blocking access with about more than 200 gigabytes of bandwidth. But the problem is, of course, we can have collisions in two ways. We can have collisions. One collision is we can have a bus collision when multiple sources try to send to the same destination. So let's say pipeline 0 and pipeline 2 want to send to the same memory bank conflict. And another possibility is that that we get a stall, and in that case we have this stall effect that a cache can say, okay, I have to stop, and to soften this effect, there are buffers in fact between the cache and between the processor and the cache. And I can show, it's easier to see when I look at this more detailed picture. So we have here the eight CPUs, and then it's sketched for one CPU. So this is replicated for each of the CPUs. We have this 124 bit bus, and we have the five destinations. And for each destination, we have here an arbiter who controls, if we have conflicts, who is allowed to forward the data. And to soften this effect, we have a queue, a two-entry queue, which means from each source, up to two packets can be buffered here. Let's, for instance, say CPU 0 sends the data. Then this data is stored here. And at the same time, the CPU 5 tries to do the same. The CPU 5 has a separate bus, and this separate bus is connected then here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 would be connected here. This would be the entry for the CPU 5. This would be the entry for the CPU 6, and so on. And you see that I have, for each CPU, I have a queue of up to two entries where I can store the entries in case of I have a conflict here on the arbiter level. And at the same time, this as well serves as a buffer in case that I get a stall because the cache bank might be too slow. So I can store up to two entries here, which means overall I can have up to 80 queue transactions here in my arbiter logic. Because this arbiter, of course, exists for every destination. So each destination has this arbiter. And you see each arbiter is connected to all the eight CPUs by a separate bus. So here, this is a quite powerful logic. So what I do is I extend the processor to cache crossbar with an arbitration, one arbiter for each destination. Okay, let's look at the crossbar in the other direction. So it's just the backward crossbar. So we have six sources, the four banks, the floating point unit, and the I/O bridge, and we have eight destinations, which are the spark cores. It's a bit different from the bus width, but from the architectural point of view, it's identical. So we have as well a separate bus, which is here in that direction, 145 bits wide, which means 128 bit data, and the rest for control. The destination ID is sent on the separate 8-bit parallel bus, and we have as well a grant in the other direction, so the crossbar sends a grant back after dispatching the packet to one of the destinations, which is one of the processor cores. But we don't have a stall condition here, just because the processors are much faster than the caches. So in this direction, we won't get an overload at any time. So the processor will always be able to process the data faster than the cache can deliver the data. And as well, since the caches are passive. The problem is on the forward network down to the caches, the cores are active, so they might produce conflict because two cores try to write through the same cache. To transfer the data from the cache back to the CPU is a reactive process. It's a reaction to a cache process. So at that point in time, all the conflicts are solved because Let's assume we have a conflict on sending. So we have core 1 and core 8 try to send at the same time. Then in case we have here the arbiter, and the arbiter schedules, then okay, let's say first 1, then 8. Then of course, as a reaction from the cache as well on the other direction, I first get the result from the 1, then I get the result to the 8. So the scheduling or the conflict solving of the parallel access is solved by the by the arbiter, which sends it down to the cache, and so the back direction doesn't have conflicts at all. And since as well the processors are faster than the caches, there will be no conflicts here, so I don't need arbiters. Okay. At least I don't need stall. I need arbiters, but I don't have a stall condition here for that. It cannot stall. So here you can see the direction. We have the 6 sources here, 4 cache sources, 1 I/O, 1 floating point sources, and we have the 8 destinations, the 8 CPUs here. Okay, so I think this gives a good impression on a bit more detailed level how the CPU cores and the caches can be interlinked, because it's a problem. If I have as more cores I have, as more I have to invest in the interconnection network. If I would just have, okay, I have 8 cores and then I just make a single bus where all the cores have to share, most of the cores would just suffer from delays many times because of bus conflicts. So I have to find a solution in the crossbar here. It's quite interesting. Quite efficient solution. But of course, you see as well on the earlier, when we looked at the die, you see that you have to pay cost for that. Now I think it's getting more clear. Let's find the die. Where's the picture with the die? Not yet here. Come on. Not yet. Here's a picture that you see that the crossbar has about the same size as a processor pipeline. And you can now imagine all the buses and the arbiters here. This is bus bundle and the arbiter, so the crossbar takes considerable space in the area because it's a quite complex network. And as more cores you have, as more complex crossbar will get. And this is one of the major problems when going to many cores. It's quite easy when looking, for instance, at graphic processing unit, GPUs. GPUs are a stream-oriented engine, so the data just flows through the CPUs. So you don't have really conflict. But if you have general-purpose processing with, let's say, 200 or 400 cores, then it's a real tough problem to interconnect these cores in a way that they can work efficiently, and not most of the cores are just stalled due to bus conflicts. So even as you see here, on having eight cores, you get a considerable area for the network, and unfortunately this does not scale linearly but with a square. That's a problem. At least if you want to be able that every CPU is connected to every part of the memory. However, having a large amount of simple CPUs has an advantage when coming to energy consumption. And this will be the last slides I have here. Okay, here a comparison between a wide-scale superscalar processor versus a quite single chip multiprocessor where each core is quite simple, like for the Niagara. So for instance, if I have a 6-way superscalar compared to a 4x2-way chip multiprocessor, so where each core is two times superscalar, but we have 4 cores, so in fact we have 1 CPU in the 6x superscalar, while we have 4 CPUs in the 4x2-way superscalar. The degree of superscalarity is 6 here, 4x2 here. The architecture is usually 32 integer registers, while here we have then of course 4x32 integer registers and 32 floating point registers on the architectural level. But on the physical level, we are quite balanced because to be able to work here efficiently, I need a bigger number of physical registers to solve all the name conflicts. Remember the false data dependencies I can solve by register renaming. So I need here a large set of physical registers. Here, since we have several cores, we don't have this problem that much. Integer function, for instance, if you have 6 times superscalar, we might have 3 integer and 3 floating point units to get overall 6. Here, for instance, each core has a single integer and a single floating point unit to get, this is also, so here, this reflects to the 6 units, and this reflects to the 2 parallel units, one floating point, one integer, but I have, since I have 4 cores, I have 4 times this. Number of load store ports, for instance, 8, one per bank, for instance, if I have 8 banks, here one in each. Branch target buffer size, for instance, 2048 entries here, a single buffer with 2048 entries, while I have 4 buffers with 512 entries. The return stack size is the same here, here a large stack, common stack, here 4 smaller stacks. Same for the instruction queue size, the caches as well here, one large cache for instruction and data, here 4 small caches. Hit time here a bit better because the cache is smaller, it's easier. Here cache interleaving perhaps for 8 banks, level 2 cache size identical in that case, memory latencies as well nearly identical, level 2 hit time, level 1 penalty, 4 to 5 cycles, so comparable. So from the overall performance, these architectures seem to be quite comparable. Interesting is now, here's another comparison about average IPC rates. AIPC means average IPC rates, measured for several benchmarks, SPEC, JBB benchmark, TPC benchmarks, XML benchmarks, on different configurations. So we have here the size of the size and architecture of the caches. This means, for instance, 16 kilobyte level 1 cache, data instruction, yes, 16 kilobytes level 1 data cache, 32 kilobytes level 1 instruction cache. So it's level 1 data instruction. This is the format here of this line. And the level 2 cache is given the size in megabytes, 1.5 megabytes, and the associativity 12-way set associative in that case. Or here, for instance, 2.5 megabytes, 10 times set associative. The number of cores which could be exploited by the benchmark. So the benchmark runs on the system, and these are the number of active cores which could be exploited there. And here is a core configuration where we have the notation X PYT, which means X is the number of scalar pipelines, and Y means the number of threads within the pipeline. So it means 1P2, which means we have one scalar pipeline which is able to execute 2 threads. Or here we have 3 scalar pipeline, each pipeline is able to execute 3 threads. And if we don't have a P but an S, then we have a superscalar pipeline, not a scalar pipeline, but a superscalar pipeline. So for instance here, 2 superscalar pipelines, 8 threaded. And here is the average IPC rate which could be could be reached. And the bold entries here are the ones which receive the most and best performance. So it's this one here, and this one here, I think this one here, and finally this one here. And you see as well, none of the best performers were in the superscalar part, all are in the scalar part. And as more threads, usually as better. So here the 16 thread configuration was the winner, and here the 12, this is a typo, the table. So just erase this 6. This is not where it's not a 612 threads, it's 12. So it's 3-threaded, 6-threaded, 12-threaded, 24-threaded. So it's just a typo, even in the book from which I got this table. So you see her having 12 to 16 threads offers best performance. Having more threads then as well, the performance increases as well. Having more cores, the performance decreases. So the best ratio is somewhere in the middle, which means have quite a simple core architecture with a sufficient number of cores and a sufficient number of threads which you can handle in parallel. And if you look now, and this was a picture that I meant, at a comparison of throughput to power, Then here is a diagram. So on this axis is a throughput, means high throughput, low throughput, and this is power, low power, high power consumption, which means this is a good area of the diagram, and this is a bad area of the diagram. So this area would mean very high power, but low performance. So this means high performance and low power. And compared here is, on one side, white issue, out of order superscalar processors, having one core, two cores, or four cores, to narrow issued in order simple scalar processors having one, two, four, or eight cores. And you see, of course, when I look at the same number of cores, for instance here, look at four number of cores, then of course the white issue outperforms the narrow issue. So here, for instance, this is the maximum performance I have here for the white issue having four cores. So four cores here. While in the narrow issue, the maximum performance is somewhere here. This is the same for more cores. But at a, you see the end of the power consumption level is lower. And when I have an 8-core narrow issue processor like here, it outperforms even the 4-core white issue processor by just lower energy consumption. So in fact, this diagram clearly shows that having more simple cores is more energy efficient, having the same performance and having a small number of really high performance, wide issue, superscalar, whatever cores. So simple chip multiplexing gains better watt per performance. So if you're interested for this book, this is a book from a conference from 2009, which I picked, so can give you the, there's much more information on that in detail, so if you're interested, I can give you the link to this book, no problem. So this is a real research. This is tapes are from research paper. So I thought it would be quite nice to conclude this lecture by such investigations. And for the very final slide here, there you can see a heat dissipation diagram of the 8-core UltraSpark to a single core wide narrow superscalar. So the size does not scale; it's just strings to have the same size. You see here the temperature as more reddish, as warmer. You see that this chip gets quite its hot spots, while this processor keeps much cooler here at the same running the same benchmark. Again, having the idea that just having 8 simple cores gives you a better watt to performance issue than having one very very complex core with the same calculation performance. Okay, so that was the final slide for this lecture. At the very end, I will just talk a little bit about the examination. Might be you're interested in. It will be an oral examination, and so we might ask you, what will I ask you in the oral examination? So of course, I will not give you very detailed information what I will ask, but so. Yeah, I don't. What I want to know are the principles. I don't want to know some kind of very very deep implementation details. So I've showed you here some processor architectures, and I won't ask you, okay, what is the cache line size of a Niragara 8 processor? So, no, I don't want to know that. So what you should know quite well about pipelining. Pipelining is important. Pipeline issues, pipeline hazards, and how to handle pipeline hazards. Speculative execution, branch prediction, techniques, different techniques for branch prediction should be as well familiar with, would be good advice. But of course, you should not forget about the basics. So when I ask you what is a von Neumann architecture, or what is a Flynn classification, should be able to give me an answer on that, what the Flynn classification, for instance, means. As well, you should be able to, for instance, to explain me the difference between a superscalar and an EPIC and a VLIW. What are the differences there? And you should be as well able to explain me how a superscalar pipeline looks like and what multithreading is and what fine-grained multithreading is. What are the advantages of fine-grained multithreading compared to coarse-grained multithreading? So that's the level of questions. So maybe just to give you one example, I might ask you, where, in which stage of the of a superscalar pipeline the true dependencies are solved, in which case the false dependencies are solved, and by which methods they are solved. This might be a question where you could talk for 5 to 10 minutes to me on how this is handled. Okay, so do you have questions? Okay, I have already put them on our server. Maybe my assistants haven't copied them, so I have, will be done this afternoon. Ja, die sind nicht bei mir.
Ja?
Können Sie sich auswählen. Also, wenn Sie sagen, wir wollen die Prüfung Englisch machen, dann machen wir es auf Englisch, aber es muss nicht sein. Ich glaube, gegen Ende hätten wir eher auf Deutsch wechseln können, da ist, glaube ich, kein Englischsprachiger mehr hier. Elektrische Schaltbilder. Also, ich kann ja skizzieren Sie mal eine superskalare Pipeline hin.
Ja.
Blockdiagramm, das ist aber elektrische Schaltbilder.
Nein.
Nein.
Ein Slide,
ein also, wie gesagt, keine Details. Ich möchte nicht wissen, welches Bit in welchem Prozessor was verantwortlich ist oder welcher Pin oder irgendwas. Oder selbst hier an der letzten Stelle, okay, was der Niagara jetzt irgendwo. Also wie viele Bits das Crossbar-Netz beim Niagara besteht, das guckt mal nach, weiß ich auch in einer Woche nicht mehr. Habe ich wieder aus meinem Gedächtnis gelöscht, das gucke ich mal vor der Vorlesung mal schnell an, dann weiß ich es auch wieder. Aber ich weiß, wo ich nachschauen muss. Also, und ich weiß, wie es funktioniert, ich weiß, was ein Crossbar ist. Also zum Beispiel wissen, was ein Crossbar ist, wie es funktioniert. Das ist interessant, aber wie viele Bits so ein Crossbar besteht. Who cares? Gut, wenn keine weiteren Fragen sind, dann beendet es die Vorlesung. Sind wir heute eine Stunde früher fertig als sonst. Dann wünsche ich Ihnen noch einen schönen Restwoche des Semesters. Viel Erfolg fürs weitere Studium. Und wie gesagt, Sie können einfach, wenn Sie es nicht gemacht haben, einmal zu meiner Sekretärin gehen mit Prüfungswunschterminen und dann finden wir einfach individuelle Prüfungstermine. Okay, das war's. That's it.